From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In this slumping economy, the issues that labor holds dear, job security, overtime and the like, have a lot more punch than they did in the go-go 90s, but is labor still a political force to be reckoned with? Tonight On Point, big labor and the Democratic hopefuls. We begin with the AFL's CIO Working Families Presidential Candidates Forum in Chicago. Each of the nine Democratic contenders will be speaking tonight in hopes of getting an endorsement from the Federation of Unions. Stephen Greenhouse covers labor issues for the New York Times. I asked him just what it was that labor wants to hear from the presidential hopefuls.
Labor wants to hear first that they can defeat George Bush. Second, that they will do some things that the union movement wants, like be tougher on trade, like favor laws that would make it easier for unions to organize. Third, maybe push for increases in minimum wage, maybe for reforming Medicare in ways that unions would like.
And which of the contenders would you say is closest to the AFL-CIO on these issues?
I think Gephardt is clearly closest. You know, Gephardt, whose father was a Teamster driver once upon a time, has been close to labor for years and years. He's very close to Jimmy Hoffa, the head of the Teamsters. He has 10 union endorsements right now. No other presidential candidate has any union endorsements. You interview labor leaders and they say, Gephardt's been with us from day one. He's with us on every issue, on trade, on labor law reform, in opposing the Bush tax cuts. They generally love Gephardt. I should say Kerry and Dean also have some support within labor.
And is that the only calculation that the AFL-CIO make, that they want a contender who's closest to them and their policies? Or do they also think, hey, is this guy going to win the presidency?
That's a good question. There really is, in many ways, a split within labor between two camps. One camp is the loyalists to Gephardt, and the other is the pragmatists. And the loyalists say Gephardt's been with us for years and years. He's gone to bat for us on many, many issues. We owe it to him out of loyalty to support him. The pragmatists say, yeah, Gephardt's pretty good. He's been with us on a lot, but would he really be the strongest candidate? And labor is very, very eager to defeat Bush. And some big unions like the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees are concerned that Gephardt might not be as strong a candidate as, say, Kerry. So several important unions are really holding back on endorsing Gephardt, even though they like Gephardt, but they feel that he might not be the strongest candidate.
So we can't take it as read that Gephardt will get the endorsement.
I wrote a story in Sunday's paper saying that it appears as if it will be difficult for Gephardt to get the two-thirds support within the AFL-CIO that is required to get its endorsement. The AFL-CIO has only endorsed two people ever before the primaries. That was Walter Mondale in 1984 and Vice President Gore 4 years ago. So it's generally a fairly high hurdle to get an endorsement before the primary. And I should add that the AFL-CIO endorsement is very important because the AFL, in ways, has more campaign activist experts out there than perhaps anybody else, more than the NRA, more than the Christian Coalition. Union members represented one-third of the delegates to the Iowa caucus 4 years ago. They represented one-fourth of the voters in the New Hampshire primary 4 years ago. And if you get their endorsement, it really helps.
But viewed also from the side of the Democratic presidential contenders, is it such a good idea for them at this time to be so closely identified with labor?
Yes and no. Gephardt clearly is eager to be closely identified, although one of Gephardt's key strategists said he realizes that some business donors that Gephardt is wooing says, you know, we're not so happy because you're so close to labor. I think all the candidates would probably be happy to get labor's endorsement, but only Gephardt has a chance. Now, of course, you're right that some candidates worry about being seen as being in bed with labor, as being too close to labor. Labor's often seen as a special interest group. And, you know, conservatives often attack candidates for being close to labor. A lot of campaign donors might be wary of contributing to a candidate very close to labor.
Now, it's one thing for the AFL-CIO to give a candidate its endorsement, but can it necessarily deliver on its members' votes?
Generally, maybe 60% of union members are Democratic, 30-40% Republican, but when the AFL, when the labor movement really gears up in support of a candidate, it can often get 70%, 75% of union members to support that candidate. And that's, I think that's a pretty good ratio, 2-1, 3-1. And in the primaries, where generally only, you know, the activists vote, labor is especially powerful because they often represent a disproportionate number of the people who vote.
Stephen Greenhouse, many thanks for that.
You're very welcome.
Stephen Greenhouse covers labor issues for the New York Times. He spoke to us from New York. As the Democratic presidential candidates vie for the attention and perhaps even an endorsement of big labor at the AFL-CIO Forum in Chicago, unions find themselves in a somewhat elevated position compared to the last election. Hard times have always brought the kinds of issues that labor rallies around to the center of the political dialogue. But is labor still a political force to be reckoned with? Are you in a union? If so, what should your leaders be telling politicians? Should the unions be backing a winner or a candidate close to labor issues? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from the forum in Chicago is Larry Scanlon, political director of the American Federation of State, County and Municipal Employees. Good evening, Mr. Scanlon.
Good evening, Julian. It's a pleasure to be talking to you here from Chicago at the forum.
Can I ask you first, why did the unions continue to support the Democratic Party? After all, the last administration was arguably no friend of the working man and woman.
Well, it's not a monolithic labor movement. We do support a lot of Republicans, and what it comes down to is who is best on the issues. What we've found at a national level is generally that the Democrats are better on the issues than the Republicans. We came out of the Bush elder administration on hard times. The economy was in bad shape. People were hurting, and we needed to change, which is why AFSCME was out early, the first union to endorse Bill Clinton, knowing that he wasn't perfect on our issues, but he was a heck of a lot better than the incumbent. And that's how we base our decision.
But how much of a say did the unions have in the shaping of the policies of the Clinton administration? Not a lot, it would seem.
Well, there was a lot of dialogue. Our president, Jerry McEntee, spent many, many hours in meetings with President Clinton. And I'll contrast that with the fact that not only have we not been at the White House since George Bush was elected, he has not even invited the president of labor, who represents the AFL-CIO, representing 13.2 million members, to the White House. So they clearly have a disdain for the working families and working union members, and that shows in their attitudes.
So what does your union want to hear from the nine Democratic presidential candidates in Chicago tonight?
Well, we view this as a reprise of the 92 election. We want to hear how you're going to get elected. We look at all the candidates, and there's nuances and some differences on issues, it's not that dramatic compared to the Bush position on issues. So we want to know, how are you electable? Who's your campaign staff? How are you raising money? What are your vote goals? What's your campaign strategy? What's your message? How are you going to get it out? And how ultimately are you going to win the general election, knowing that George Bush has the power of the incumbency and probably $200+ million to work with?
Electability, is that more important than necessarily subscribing to the values of labor?
Well, we would not support a candidate who didn't support our values. But when you look at any of the nine candidates, their values in terms of labor issues are much closer than George Bush's. So it's really a no-brainer in that regard. So our pick is which of the nine really are best in terms of getting elected.
And will your union back the candidate chosen by the AFL-CIO if one is endorsed?
Well, that's a very interesting question. We are going through our own endorsement process. We started out with a town hall meeting in Iowa in May with 1,000 of our leaders and activists there listening to the candidates. We have done discussions at council conventions in each state, the Women's Conference. We are doing polling of a 4,200-member sample. We're going to do an email poll. We are asking each of the candidates to come in to our executive board meeting in early September individually and present their plans and persuade us why they are the best candidate. At that point, I think we're in a position to make an endorsement, which I suspect that we will do either late September or early October. We think that the Federation will not be able to muster a two-thirds majority for any candidate, and the best guess that we have is that they will basically stay out of the primary until there's a presumptive nominee.
As a matter of interest, how many members does your Federation have? How many voters, potentially, could you deliver in 2004?
We have nearly 1.4 million members. Our registration rate is currently over 70%. We usually have a 70% or better turnout of our members, and our polling shows that they vote for the endorsed candidate 70% of the time. We are embarking on additional voter registration. And I think what's interesting, what's happened over the last three or four election cycles, there's been a change in the philosophy not only of our union but all the unions. It's no longer, you know, we make an endorsement and tell the members who to vote for. We spend a lot of money and energy basically doing issue papers and communicating with our members and saying, here are the issues. We inform, you decide. And our members are pretty smart. They make the right decisions.
And as you say, your members have some pretty mixed political views.
They do. Our union actually is probably about 40% Democratic, 30% Republican, 30% Independent. So we're all over the board because we represent workers virtually in every state. We have some federal workers, we have some private sector workers, and a lot of state, county, and municipal workers.
Do you believe that the unions still do have political clout, even though membership is diminishing?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the numbers, in the 92 election, unions were, I believe it was 19% of the vote. I'm sorry, 14% of the vote. They jumped up to 19, then up to 26% in the 2000 election. Unions are very credible messengers with their members when we're delivering information. And I heard part of Steve Greenhouse's comments, and he's absolutely right. When you have a smaller universe of voters, when you have an organized machine that can go out and educate voters and mobilize them, you have a disparate impact on the outcome.
So your strength is more in the delivery of voters, you reckon, than the shaping of policy?
No, we spend a lot of time trying to shape policy because that's what you're delivering the goods in terms of representing your members. So we have, for example, just come through a huge fight with the Bush administration trying to get additional aid to the states who are suffering from a huge fiscal crisis. One, they have unfunded mandates, Homeland Providers and Leave No Child Behind, but they're not getting the dough to take care of the problem. So they're looking at job cuts, wage freezes, raising taxes. So we fought very hard to shape that legislation, and ultimately we got $20 billion in the tax cut bill to go back to the states to help them with their budgets. So policy is very important to us.
So it's important, in your opinion, for a candidate to get an endorsement from the AFL-CIO?
Not only the AFL-CIO, but the constituent unions, because we each have our own political programs that deliver volunteers and money to other campaign resources. So it's very important to get that support.
But if a candidate doesn't have union support, it doesn't necessarily mean that he is unelectable.
No, it just means they have to work that much harder to identify swing voters and get them educated, persuaded, and then mobilized.
Okay, Larry Scanlon, political director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Many thanks.
Julian, it was a pleasure talking with you.
We're talking tonight about whether Labour is still a political force to be reckoned with. Do you belong to a union? If so, what should your leaders be telling politicians in Chicago? Should the unions be backing a winner or a candidate who's close to Labour issues? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the impact of Labour on the Democratic primary and whether Labour is still a political force to be reckoned with. Would a union endorsement make you more or less likely to vote for a candidate? Should the unions be backing a winner or a candidate close to Labour issues? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Labour expert Harley Shaken, Professor of Social and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Good evening to you, Mr. Shaken.
Good evening.
And by Thomas Edsel, political correspondent for The Washington Post. Thomas Edsel, good evening to you, too.
How are you?
Harley Shaken, we were hearing earlier on from Larry Scanlon, political director of the American Federation of State, County and Municipal Employees, that he felt the union still had a fairly central part to play in the political process, certainly when it came to the Democratic Party. Do you share that view?
I do. I think they have a very central role to play, certainly in the political process. As he pointed out, in the 2000 elections, over one out of every four voters was either a union member or came from a union household. But however important their role is in the general election, it is significantly more important in the Democratic primary, because they're not simply a source of funds, as critical as that is, but they're able to mobilize people, where turnout is smaller, particularly in caucus states, that mobilization can be decisive.
So it's their organizational abilities, as I said, rather than their ability to shape policy that is their strength for the Democratic Party?
I think it's really both. They organize because they want to shape policy. They feel that it is pivotal to represent their members effectively, not just to try to do it at the bargaining table or in organizing campaigns, but in the political process. And one of the paradoxes of American politics in recent years is, as unions have shrunk as a percentage of the workforce, as they've been hit with all these unfavorable forces, their political clout may in fact have increased in terms of their effectiveness at all levels of politics, and in terms of influencing votes, influencing their members, and really being able to deliver on election day.
Thomas Edsel, looking at it from the other point of view, are the Democratic Party, do you think, still comfortable with the relationship that they have with the unions, with organized labor?
In general, yes, and labor is a crucial factor for winning. And I would say in general elections, they've become, since 1994 when they did poorly, they've become an increasingly an important factor. There is some tension, though, particularly over trade issues. The manufacturing and industrial sector unions have become increasingly critical and have turned into litmus test issues, votes on free trade. And there are a number of Democratic presidential candidates who have supported free trade issues. That is a real conflict.
Harley Shaken, do you see any difference in the way the unions are approaching next year's election? It's noticeable the fact that nine presidential contenders have taken the bother to go to Chicago.
This is the first time, in fact, they may have all been together in an event like this, and it really does show the importance of it. The unions have learned a lot over the last three or four elections, and they've built on that knowledge. It isn't simply trying to tell their members how to vote. That tends to backfire, but rather trying to educate them on the issues, bring them into the process, reflect where they are, but take them in a direction that the union leaders think will be beneficial to labor. I agree with Tom that the fault line that runs through the Democratic Party right now is on trade. And the industrial unions in particular, but labor more generally, is very anti-unregulated trade and very much for labor and environmental standards. And that's clearly a challenge to some of the candidates within the Democratic primaries.
So to that extent, we can expect labor in Chicago to be ruling out quite emphatically a number of those candidates in terms of the positions they've taken in the past on free trade.
I don't think they'll rule them out. John Kerry has voted incorrectly, in quotes, on a number of trade issues, but he is still, Jerry McEntee from Larry Scanlon's union, the head of it, is giving serious consideration to John Kerry. And that's true of other candidates. It's not, the real question is the tension in labor between electability and commitment to labor. That's an area where labor itself has to work out what its strategy is going to be.
Holly Shaken.
Yes, I think Tom has a very good point here. I think the unions are at great pains not to rule anyone out on a single issue, no matter how pivotal that is. Some of the unions may, but overall, I suspect most won't. And there is that tension between electability and a candidate that is very close to labor. But in a way, electability is a very elusive term. Many candidates that in the past, unions or other social or political forces have viewed as very electable have imploded before the final election. So there's a real, I think, core desire to unseat President Bush. There's a real feeling that this can be done. And unions are trying to balance the notion of someone that will carry a labor agenda forward and a broader agenda on working families and someone that has at least a feasible chance of winning.
Well, Palak's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Good evening to you, Palak. And you want to address yourself to this issue of electability.
I do. You know, I kind of feel like there's a slight false dichotomy being set up between electability and being close to issues of labor. And, you know, my point really on that is I feel like, you know, in this Democratic primary, we do have a candidate that's really close to issues of labor and working in poor people, working class and poor people, and that's Dennis Kucinich. And I feel as though, you know, people are automatically saying, well, yeah, Dennis is a great candidate, but let's just dismiss him because he's not electable. And I kind of feel, you know, if the previous speaker that you had on that was saying, you know, 14% of labor accounts for in the election or whatnot, then labor does, you know, labor can actually affect the outcome of this election by kind of actually siding with the issues of its members rather than kind of selling its members out and kind of taking. I mean, I was just shocked to hear that previous guy that you had on from the representing the state and municipal workers, just because of his, like, let's pay attention to the strategies and how much money they've raised as opposed to whether or not this person actually represents the membership that he is supposedly being paid to represent.
Well, I suppose Mr. Scanlon might be said to represent the pragmatist element within the organized labor rather than what are described sometimes as the loyalists. Harley Shaken, you see that tension within organized labor?
Sure, that tension has always been there between the pragmatist and the loyalist, but it isn't quite just the pragmatist and the loyalist. There are a number of things that go into a candidate really winning, and I think three things stand out certainly in this presidential cycle. One is ideas, that is having the ideas that are going to excite people, that are going to resonate, that really are going to shape the campaign. The second is organization. Because the ideas alone won't work in any campaign, and organization is pivotal. And the third is money. All these three things, whether we like it or not, come together to shape how a campaign is going to be run and shape who might win this primary season and stand a good chance of beating President Bush in the general election. So for unions, it isn't simply looking at old loyalties. It's looking towards the future and asking the pivotal question, how best can an agenda favorable to working families be implemented, and who is the candidate that can carry that forward? One criteria is a reasonable chance of being elected. A second criteria, of course, is the ideas, and the third is looking at overall how the candidate is doing. So all these things come together. It's not just a simple split between the pragmatist and the loyalist.
Thomas Edsel?
I agree. I mean, Dennis Kucinich has got to prove a lot that he's really just a blip in the polls right now. If he is a credible candidate, he is getting some exposure at these various forums and other events, and he's got to basically prove he's a credible candidate by showing that he can start winning support that shows up, at least in modest measure, in the surveys of Democratic primary voters and caucus goers in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. That hasn't happened yet, and to have labor take a risk on something like that would be a real tough choice for labor to make.
I mean, I think the point that Palak was probably trying to make, Thomas Edsel, was why is it that a measure of a credibility of a candidate, of what is, I suppose, in very broad terms, the Democratic Party, a centre-left party. Why shouldn't it be the candidate who embraces the values of organised labour?
Well, most of the candidates do embrace most of the values of organized labor. I don't think there's a single candidate running that labor would be really upset with, particularly. But it's just part of politics is that no one satisfies everybody. Even Dick Gephardt probably has some votes, and he certainly did back in his younger days, that would not be acceptable to labor. And Denis Kucinich has switched his position, for example, with another major interest group, which is advocates of abortion rights. He's gone from being a opponent of abortion rights to basically acceding to them. No one's got pure hands in this whole process. So you basically, anyone on the left or right wants to find someone who can represent their interests as best possible and win.
Okay. Anyone other than George Bush, I think, looks very good to the Democrats right now, although I suspect that Gephardt clearly has the hand up in terms of union support. Whether or not he reaches the magic threshold of two-thirds of the members of the AFL-CIO is one thing, but he's already got 10 or 11 major unions and will likely get more. And those unions, the support on a union level is really quite pivotal, because that's where money, where troops are, where the phone calls are made, where the mobilization takes place.
Dave's calling from Cassinovia, Wisconsin. Dave, you're a long-standing union member.
Yeah, I was a member of the Teamsters for 8.5 years, and I've currently been a member of the Sheet Metal Workers Union for roughly the last 5 years. My main issue is that the unions, although have tremendous amount of power, it's not the union's fault. It comes down to the Democrats actually alienating other groups, pissing off like the NRA. And right there, that group, if we could actually tame that shrew, it'd give us a little bit more power base to go up against George W. I mean, I love the labor practices of the Democrats, but after the actions in the Clinton administration with Janet Reno going after the gun manufacturers, couldn't take the risk. There's a lot of us with Midwestern values that, yes, hunting and other recreations actually sometimes become paramount.
So what do you think the AFL-CIO should be doing tonight in Chicago as they look at these 9 presidential hopefuls?
Well, it's not so much what the union can do. It's what our Democratic candidates could do by trying to woo other special interests such as the NRA to actually take them out of George W.'s power base. I mean, every little bit helps. And actually, you look at the last election, although everybody brings up the Supreme Court case, but let's face fact, early on, Gore made comments basically saying he was gun grabber just like Janet Reno. And then all of a sudden he got a backlash, and all of a sudden he stutter-stepped. He said, oh, no, I won't do anything with your firearms. It was already too late. He ticked off a lot of voters, and even myself, and there's quite a few of my union fellow union members, that was enough.
I think the caller has a point, but it's more complex. The problem is that within the Democratic Party and among some of its active supporters, there are, just as there are the caller, a union member who's also a supporter of gun rights, there are many Democrats who are active proponents of gun control. And it's hard for the candidates to break with that constituency, which probably within the Democratic Party is now stronger than the advocates of gun rights.
But to that extent, Thomas Edsel, isn't it a bit, haven't politics moved on? We're getting this spectacle tonight in Chicago of one monolithic block coming together to give its support to another monolithic block. It just doesn't work.
Well, I don't think that's actually what's going to happen in Chicago. I think that labor has laid out 5 broad areas of concern They want to hear the candidates. Labor's not monolithic, and certainly the candidates aren't monolithic in terms of how they're going to approach these five issues, that is jobs, health, trade, corporate accountability, and organizing for unions. There's a lot of diversity within labor, and certainly even more diversity among labor members. But key to the Democrats, and certainly key to this endorsement process, is what's going to happen with the economy, what's going to happen with globalization, issues such as health care, these broad issues that the president will shape, and where union leaders and many, many union members are very dissatisfied with the Bush administration, is what's going to, I think, really define the next election. Not to say that issues like gun control are unimportant. They're very important. I'm from Michigan. I remember hunting season, and I know how important these issues are to union members. But there's a lot of differences here, yet there are some broader issues where there may be more unity, and these may define the election.
Thomas Edsel, the broad brush approach.
I think the labor movement is in real trouble in one respect. It has just been stagnating membership-wise. It's become very influential politically because it's been able to mobilize the 13 million members it does have very effectively over the past decade. But it, as an institution, it's been on the losing end of the stick and declining in overall leverage. It's a dilemma, and labor is getting, to some degree, kind of desperate. And the degree to which a Democratic candidate can kind of balance that pressure and keep the labor movement a loyal constituent is going to probably be a factor in how good the Democratic candidate performs in the general election.
So very briefly, do you think, Thomas Edsel, then, that the Democratic Party are simply paying lip service to the unions?
No, I think they're paying, they certainly are more pro-union, per se, than the Republican Party. And the Bush administration has been, I think, very purposefully has attacked a number, especially the public sector unions. If labor has to bet a poker hand, it's going to take the Democratic hand and not the Republican one at this point, except for one or two possible unions that might defect.
Okay, Holly, we've got to take a break there, Holly Shaken. Thomas Edsel, many thanks for having been with us tonight. That was Thomas Edsel, political correspondent for The Washington Post. Still with us, though, labor expert Holly Shaken, professor of social and cultural studies at the University of California, Berkeley. We're discussing labor and the Democratic primary. Should the unions be backing a winner or a candidate close to labor issues? Would a union endorsement make you more or less likely to vote for a candidate? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support.
I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about labor unions and the Democratic primary. Is labor still a political force to be reckoned with? Do you belong to a union? Should the unions be backing a winner or a candidate close to labor issues? Would a union endorsement make you more or less likely to vote for a candidate? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Holly Shaken, professor of social and cultural studies at the University of California, Berkeley. And let's take a call from Daniel. He's calling from Warren, Pennsylvania. Good evening to you, Daniel.
Good evening. I wanted to call because I'm a union Republican, a member of the Carpenters Union. And I just wanted to say that I became a union Republican because during the 60s, 70s, and early 80s especially, I felt that the union leadership at the time was looking out after their own interests and not the interests of the workers. And the overtones and the way I felt that we were being treated as workers was that we were almost considered, well, you do what we say, and you don't have a voice really in it. Sure, you can vote at the union hall and all that, but we tell you what to do. Well,
so in what way, Daniel, were the union leaders' interests different from you, a member, a worker?
Well, I think for one was that they overstepped what I consider the bounds of union leadership, in that they, as far as issues go, they became involved in issues outside of labor. Issues like I heard a lot from the educators' unions and stuff like that, dealing with their support of, we'll say, the abortion issue, so-called women's rights, and going beyond labor issues. And as far as on-the-job type situations, it became a situation where frequently, if you didn't have the good connections with the union leadership, you had a tougher time getting work. You became a little more, not really blackballed, but at times, if you weren't on their good side, you were, especially like construction trades, you were going to find yourself sitting on a bench more often than someone who went to all the meetings and followed all the rules or all their rules that the business steward, business agent wanted you to fulfill.
Okay, Daniel, look, many thanks for that. Harley Shaken, we haven't brought you on here to defend the unions, but I think Daniel does make quite an interesting point there, the extent to which the unions perhaps see themselves sometimes as a separate political and social entity, and sometimes maybe divorced from the interests of their workers, the people they're meant to be representing.
Well, I think Daniel raises some very important points, and I think this is one of the things that both concerns union leaders and which they are far more aware of today than they were, let's say, a decade ago. Daniel's hardly alone in not simply in being a union Republican, but also the sense that many union members do not like to be told how to vote. They react negatively to that, and unions have found this out. That's why, as Larry Scanlon pointed out earlier, there's a much greater emphasis on educating their members, on finding out where the members are at, and bringing them along to a broad agenda that will favor working families. It's a real challenge for unions, but the Daniels of this world, I think, are very much in the mind of the union leaders who are meeting in Chicago right now in terms of how to include that perspective and how to mobilize the union members that are out there for this broader agenda that will increase the power of working families within the economy and the political process.
So it's even possible that an endorsement from the AFL-CIO for a candidate in Chicago tonight or in the coming weeks could be counterproductive, certainly be counterproductive for Daniel.
Not necessarily. It depends. No matter who an individual union endorses and no matter who the AFL-CIO endorses, there will be people who disapprove of it. It's rather how broad the tent is and how many members can be brought along. In the 2000 election, we've mentioned a number of times that over one out of four families or one out of four voters was a union family. Well, Gore was favored by 22%, by a 22% margin over President Bush in that election among this union grouping. So in that sense, the union leaders did a very good job of bringing the members along in that election. So it's not that there won't be dissent. Everyone won't be happy, but that there will be a sense of inclusion and a broader sense of education rather than simply saying that vote this way.
Well, Nancy is calling from Clinton, Massachusetts. What would you like to say, Nancy?
Well, I am a member of a union when I teach in public schools. I was wondering if the general perception of unions has improved, or the options for unions are improving with Bush's missteps economically, Halliburton contracts and other things, indicating that we're all in it together. It really isn't union for other people.
Harley Shaken?
Well, I think right now, if we didn't have unions, we'd have to invent them, given the perceptions of a lot of people, of corporations that have, you know, committed these misdeeds, of this real lack of accountability, of an erosion of trust, of all these things that we've read and heard and seen so much about with the Enrons and the WorldComs and the other corporations, not that have gone down this road. So the unions have emerged in these times and during a period of a very uncertain economy where the employment numbers remain quite rocky as the place that many people are looking for an alternative perspective to be brought into the political process. That's very important for unions, but it's also very important for Democrats. The most recent polls over the last several days show a much greater confidence in Democrats on economic issues than in the president and Republicans. That's changed over the last number of months. So I think we're seeing that kind of movement, and unions under these circumstances, it's very hard to paint them as a special interest, and they assume a broader role of saying, look, we're trying to defend a set of issues that concern ordinary Americans that may have been bypassed in the political process right now.
Nancy, do you trust the judgment of union leaders? As a union member and maybe a Democrat, would you vote for the candidate that was endorsed by the AFL-CIO in Chicago?
I go along with the opinion stated that union members want to be educated, but we don't want to be told how to vote. So with the funding cutbacks and different correspondence we were asked to make to our senators and representatives recently, I did not always write with the party line. I did on some issues, and I did contact my representatives.
Okay, Nancy, thanks for that. Joe's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. What did you want to say, Joe?
Yeah, the crimes of this Bush crime family are so bad that I think it's going to take, as Shaken says, this is Freer, by the way, it's going to take that alternative perspective. And as the previous caller said, we're all in this together. We need a big tent. We need the Greens, the unions, the Libertarians, the Ross Perot people from 92. We need everybody together around the common agenda. And as Larry Scanlon, the great AFL guy, says, we got to be pragmatic. We got to ask everybody, what's your idea? How can we, like the political parties in Europe, they weigh everything, they form coalitions to get these people that knew about 9/11 and permitted it to happen out of power. We've got to, and I suggest this is the agenda. We got to get out of this stranglehold of the money system. We got to get people back to the land to grow their own vegetables. Every church should have a little farm. We have to break the bonds of this rat race, wage slave, disenslavement.
Okay, Joe, many thanks for that. Joe calling there from Madison, Wisconsin. And Joe, clearly with a very broad agenda. Holly Shaken, though, maybe he was touching there on the bigger picture, which is choosing a candidate, the Democrats, who can beat an incumbent who is viewed as hostile to workers' rights.
I think what's really important, and one of the things that labor has learned that's different about Chicago right now than, say, a decade ago, is a decade ago what might have been important is who the union leaders favor in Chicago. Now the union leaders themselves want to know how they can mobilize the local unions, their members, communities, church groups, environmental groups, how they can work in concert and build that broader movement that's going to shape the electoral process. That's a sea change, and that makes what happens in Chicago very important, but in a sense the tip of the iceberg in this broader process of the role that labor plays in terms of this broader coalition through the primaries and into the general election. That's the real challenge that the unions are looking at. And one of the paradoxes is, with a Republican president and Republican houses of Congress, that the big money has left for the Republican Party, making labor an even more central actor within the Democratic Party in terms of resources and the ability to mobilize.
Let's hear from Gloria. She's calling from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Good evening, Gloria.
Oh, good evening, and thank you for taking my call. I am a former Reagan Republican and have voted Republican for many, many, many years until the end of Reagan's term. And I just wanted to comment, I'm not a union member, have never been a union member, but I would take a very close look at the membership and their endorsement of the candidates, what unions endorse whom. I think that our workers have been so appallingly treated by the Republican administration, and it gets worse and worse. You're quite right to say that they're quite hostile to workers' rights. But I really feel that Wall Street, between Wall Street and Republican, the current administration, has just been so damaging to the man who's really trying to work and take care of his family. And although, as I said, I'm not a union member and never have been, I am very, very concerned about what's going to come in the future. And I would take a very close look at who the unions are going to represent, because they have been treated so shabbily. And perhaps I shouldn't bring this in. I can't remember what I said to whoever took my call, but the thing on the gun issue, I think, is, you know, we're so obsessed with guns in this nation, and I do take exception to one of the previous callers who said that we really should get back, you know, and allow the Democratic candidates to be more lenient with the gun situation. But that's my comment.
Gloria, many thanks for that. Holly Shaken, that was Gloria, not a union member, a former Republican voter, and yet she'd take the advice of the AFL-CIO leadership in Chicago. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's music certainly to the ears of the AFL-CIO leadership and other union leaders, but I think it also may reflect a broader sentiment that may be running through this election cycle. In 1984, when unions endorsed Walter Mondale, Walter Mondale became tarred as the captive of special interests. I suspect that's not going to happen this time around, because unions are playing a role of defending ordinary people in a very hostile economy and in a very uncertain economic world. And for unions, that both increases their leverage and energizes them and their ability to act by attracting people like Gloria, who want a sense of fair play, who want to see people treated fairly, who want to see a sense of the American values that we broadly share really reflected politically as well as economically. So I think that to the extent that Gloria's sentiments are more widely shared, this could bode well for labor.
So we have a paradox, Holly, if I could just conclude, where the unions seem at the moment to be coming into their own, largely as a result of a president who wishes they'd go away.
Absolutely. That's one of the ironies here, that unions, whom many had written off economically and politically not too many years ago, all of a sudden in this election cycle are showing a new vitality that they hope will not only shape American politics, but translate to the bargaining table, to organizing victories, to other things down the road. They still face enormous challenges, but they're going in with, I think, a certain level of confidence into this electoral cycle. And what happens, we will see very soon.
Harley, many, many thanks for being with us. That was Harley Shaken, Professor of Social and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amada, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Judy Jopp and Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks.